I'm recording. I'll just note that.
Great. Well, then I will call the January 13th, 2021 meeting of the Vina Groundwater Sustainability Agency meeting to order. I'm Evan Tuschinski, vice chair of the agency. This meeting is being conducted via teleconference in accordance with Executive Order N-25-20 and N-29-20. Members of the public may virtually attend the meeting remotely via the Zoom platform. The public may listen to and or participate in the Vina Groundwater Sustainability Agency board meetings via landline or mobile telephone or via computer with both audio and video enabled or audio only. If you wish to comment on an item but do not wish to participate during the meeting, the public may submit comments via email to vinagsapublic.comments@chico.ca.gov. Please submit separate emails with the subject line public comment item number and then the item number. The public is encouraged to send no more than one email per item or comment on numerous items in one email. With that, we will go to item 1.1, call to order. Well, I just did that, sorry. item 1.2, roll call.
Okay, so we have board member Denley.
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you. Board member Cooper.
I'm here.
Board member Royer.
Here.
Board member Kimmelshue.
Here.
And then Vice Chair Tuschinski.
Here.
So all are present.
Okay. Item 1.3, election of the chair and vice chair. I will turn that over to the management committee.
Yes, thank you. So as a first meeting with the new board members, this is an opportunity as also the first of the year. This is the time we would elect a chair and a vice chair. So we would take nominations for the chair first and then the vice chair second. Any nominations for the chair?
Yeah, Linda, this is Todd Kimmelshue. I'd like to nominate Evan Tuschinski as our chair.
Okay, thank you. Is there a second?
I would like to second that. Raymond Cooper.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so we have a motion from to elect Evan Tuschinski, board member Tuschinski, to chair. All those in favor? I'll do a roll call, I guess.
Aye.
I forgot. Yeah, I'll do a roll call. Sorry. Board member Denley?
Yes.
Board member Cooper?
Aye.
Board member Royer?
Aye.
Board member Kimmelshue?
Yes.
And then I assume Tuschinski would say yes.
Yes. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Sorry, I forgot that because we have some that may be audio only. We typically do a roll call. I should have remembered that. Sorry. Okay, so we have any nominations for the vice chair?
Again, this is Todd Kimmelshue. I would nominate Jeff Royer.
I'd like to second that.
Okay, we have a motion to elect board member Royer as a vice chair. Board member Denley?
Aye.
Board member Cooper?
Aye.
Board member Royer?
Aye.
Board member Kimmelshue?
Yes.
And chair now, Tuschinski?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. We will go on to the consent agenda. Our matters that are listed in the consent agenda are to be considered routine and enacted by one motion. Item 2.1 is approval of the December 9th, 2020 Vina GSA board meeting minutes. Item 2.2 are approval of the Vina GSA monthly financial status report. Does any member of the board wish to pull one of these two items for discussion separately? Hearing none, does any member of the board wish to discuss any of these items? I know there's a member of the public who wishes to ask about one of these items. So I'll open up for public comment now. If we could unmute Supervisor Lucero and then if anybody else does. The process that we use, by the way, for public comment is we use the hand raising. She mentioned this before the meeting, so I do happen to know this, but that she's interested. But if we could please use the hand raising mechanism in the participants window, that would be great. Or somehow make yourself known to Linda Herman, that would be fantastic. So Supervisor Lucero?
Yes, I was just noticing in the minutes that it listed Alex Brown as absent as an alternate member. And I was just wondering why I've sat on this commission or the GSA for 2 years, but I've never been listed as an alternate member. So if we're going to list an alternate member as absent, wouldn't we list alternate members as present?
I can answer that question. Because Chair Schwab was no longer a chair member, a council member, nor a board member as of December 1st, we invited the alternate Alex Brown for that one meeting. So she was representing the city of Chico, not as an alternate in general, but the actual representative standing in for the what was Chair Schwab's position.
I still think it's a little confusing. The way it was written, I'm still confused.
Well, we can scratch alternate if that makes it more clear, because she was the Chico representative.
Yeah, I think that would be more clear. I just wanted clarification on that. Thank you.
That edit seems acceptable to me, but again, I'll open the floor up to any motion, and if a member wishes to include that edit in the motion, that seems like a sound process.
So this seems to be it's an understandable technicality since Anne Schwab was no longer a Chico city council member and therefore no longer on our board. Did that automatically elevate Alex Brown to a full standing board member? In which case the edit would make sense to me.
Yeah, in this case, because we had not yet met as the city council to appoint a primary member yet, that alternate was the only available position that could stand in for Chair Schwab.
All right, then I'm not opposed to amending the language to drop the reference to alternate, since technically that would have made her a board member temporarily.
Would anyone care to make a motion on the consent agenda? And they're welcome to add that as an amendment to their motion if they are so inclined.
I move to adopt the consent agenda with the amendment to the language to remove the reference of alternate to Alex Brown's, any references to Alex Brown in the minutes.
Is there a second?
I would second that, Cammie Denley.
Great. Thank you. Any further discussion? Hearing none, if we could have a vote, please. Linda?
Certainly. Board Member Denley?
Aye.
Board Member Cooper?
Aye.
Board Member Royer?
Aye.
Board Member Kimmelshue?
Yes.
And Chair Chasinski?
Aye.
Thank you.
Seeing no items removed from consent, we will move to business from the floor. Members of the public may address the board at this time on any matter not already listed on the agenda. Comments are limited to 3 minutes. The board cannot take any action at this meeting on requests made under this section of the agenda. Linda, do you see anybody indicating they wish to speak on this item?
I do not, and I do not have any emails as well.
Okay. Item 5, notice public hearings, none. So item 6, regular agenda. 6.1, update on the development of the VINA Groundwater Sustainability Plan, GSP. Paul Gosselin.
Thank you. Good evening. I'm Paul Gosselin. I'm going to give an overview of the Groundwater Sustainability Plan. I can share my screen right now.
Please.
Is that up on the screen?
I'm not seeing it.
Is my presentation up?
No.
Okay. Let me hit share screen. There we go.
There.
Getting there. So you can see that?
Yes.
Okay, very good. Thank you. So tonight, I'm going to give an overview of the groundwater sustainability plan status for the Vina Subbasin. As we sit here on the 13th of January, in just about a year from now, we're going to have this plan submitted into DWR. I'll go over the schedule, but as I'll emphasize, the big lift to get this plan submitted in is not the end of the process. It actually just begins the entire journey to make sure that we're taking those steps to sustain the basin. So as I always do, I like to cover all the elements that we need to submit as part of the plan. And these are the regulatory requirements. The basin setting work had been drafted over the summer, and that's in draft form. We're focused right now on sustainable management criteria, representative monitoring, which is under monitoring networks, projects and actions, and there's other sections also in the administrative information, including the costs, and we'll get into that for implementation. So between now and June, which is shortly 6 months, the primary emphasis is going to be on the sustainable management criteria, the representative monitoring network, which I'll cover in a little bit more detail today. Interbasin coordination, projects and management actions, and the implementation cost and funding options. And we haven't really spoken much about this, is that in the plan, we are required to list out what the cost is to actually implement the plan. We've been kind of benefited by having a grant and in-kind staff support to develop the plan for submission, which is an important piece. But the actually carrying it out is going to have its own cost, particularly on projects and management actions. And we need to lay those out and talk about what funding streams are. And that'll be a discussion for the board in the future. So tonight I'll be covering a real high level overview of the methodology that was proposed, draft methodology that was proposed and discussed at the Stakeholder Advisory Committee in December. That included a discussion of representative monitoring sites and how they fit into sustainable management criteria. I'll give a brief overview of project management actions and update on interbasin coordination. And then, of course, the board can provide direction to staff as appropriate. So in February, and this is another key element, and back to as we start looking at the concepts for sustainable management criteria, which are again gonna be discussed at the Stakeholder Advisory Committee next Tuesday in more detail, we are slated for the next board meeting to craft that as a single item as a board workshop. It's something that we had talked about a few meetings ago, and we thought it would be really advantageous to lay out the proposed draft sustainable management criteria to the public. That will also kick off a 30-day public comment period, but also cover that through a Vina GSA board workshop. And that would allow for the board to fully engage and the public in discussion of how we're going to craft the sustainable management criteria. In March, we'll have a 30-day public comment period on the representative monitoring network. And then between April and May, and this is all of these items are going to come up from discussions with the Stakeholder Advisory Committee, the sustainable management criteria, project management actions, including costs and funding options, the representative monitoring, and data gaps, which is also going to be another important piece of the plan and interface and coordination. And then by June, we should be looking at having those draft projects and management actions, and we'll be putting those out for public comment period. We'll continue discussion on interbasin coordination. And then June, we're going to start reviewing the chapters, including the implementation draft chapter, because we'll start, once we get sustainable management criteria somewhat drafted up and project management actions, we'll start to look at what is this going to cost over time and what are those sources of funding we're going to look at for implementation. And that's going to include also data gaps, which is also a key component. And that will be out for public comment in July. And then August, we're going to start to pull together, compiling all these sections, including base and setting, all these other components into the compiled draft, complete Vina groundwater sustainability plan. By September, we're going to put it out for a 60-day public comment period, and that's also going to afford the land use agencies they're required 60-day public comment period. We're required to give land use agencies 60-day public comment period, but we're going to afford the entire public 60 days. And then we're slated November, December to have Vina board hearings and adoptions, and fit in some time to do that with. Hopefully by January, we'll have it approved. And then we can, in January, start going through the submission into the portal and to DWR to submit that. And then really it's going to be implementation. It's going to start taking all those actions and steps we're going to take, and particularly start looking at some of the data gaps and actions we need to take, which is going to be an ongoing process for the future to sustain the basin. So very exciting times ahead, a lot of work ahead. But we're on schedule, and I'll start right in talking about the draft sustainable management criteria methodology. I did include the entire presentation that the GeoSynTech team presented to the Stakeholder Advisory Committee in December as background. I am not going to go through that entire slide set. It's very detailed. And that isn't the purpose of the discussion today. What I wanted to do was to at least get you familiar with the methodology that was being discussed with the Stakeholder Advisory Committee. And so when we have the workshop, the public workshop in February, you'll be familiar with that, but we'll also include what recommendations and discussions come from the Stakeholder Advisory Committee. What is a sustainable management criteria? Well, one aspect is it has to have a sustainability goal. And this statement is a brief statement. It's usually a page or two, just describing what you're intending to do to sustain the basin, what you're intending to protect, and your approach to doing that. And really, when the sustainable management criteria went into place, sustainability wasn't something that it was defined by determining what we don't want to have, what bad things, the undesirable things we don't want to have happen to those who rely on groundwater. It was by defining the negative and avoiding those and assuring that they're sustainable. And you also need to include the measures that are going to take to manage the basin. So you just can't identify where you want the basin to be sustainably without the means to get there. Otherwise, you're setting your plan up for failure. So there has to be connection with projects and management actions to ensure that you're going to get there along the way. So if there's no undesirable results occurring and the basin's operating within its sustainable yield, how much can it draw out sustainably? Then it's achieving their goal. And we'll have a couple of iterations on this methodology. So again, it's trying to avoid causing undesirable results from sustainability indicators. And those are, persistent lowering of groundwater levels, which will be the driver, and I'll talk about that. And then significant and unreasonable reductions in groundwater storage, significant and unreasonable saltwater intrusion, which we won't have to deal with, significant and unreasonable degradation of water quality, significant and unreasonable land subsidence, and surface water depletion having significant and unreasonable effects on beneficial uses. So significant and unreasonable was inserted into the law specifically because it was deemed as a discretionary action of the local agency. It's something that determining what's sustainable in the basin at the local level is not something that the state's going to determine for us, provided we don't let them intervene. We have to make a call that whatever we do is, those undesirable results are significant and unreasonable, and that's gonna be based upon data and the means to sustain the basin with input from the public and responses to public comment. So again, the sustainability indicators are here. We X'd out seawater intrusion. And on the right-hand side, this list of beneficial uses and users comes from the Act. And it lists out ag groundwater users, domestic well users, municipal water suppliers, environmental uses, surface water, land use agencies, and down the line. So all of these entities, including groundwater dependent ecosystems, are uses that we need to look at to determine whether they're significant or unreasonable impacts from where the basin is. So how do you get there? One aspect is you need to set a minimum threshold, and this is the point where an undesirable result would occur. So what you need to set that is your minimum threshold is where you're starting to have impacts to groundwater uses and users. You don't want to get near or approach or exceed your minimum threshold because you want to avoid undesirable results. So what you need to do is, and so the minimum threshold is the floor that you want to be protecting. Setting you above that is your measurable objective. So above your minimum threshold, your measurable objective is where you want the basin to operate through wet and dry cycles and through future conditions in a period that is sufficiently far away from your minimum threshold to take in uncertainty and other conditions for the future. So you're going to avoid undesirable results that are determined at your minimum threshold. So here's a slide, and I will say the 2040 date, this is a slide for critically overdrafted subbasins, which had to submit their plans by 2020, and their compliance date is 2040. Ours is 2042. But what this illustrates is, and this is from a DWR guidance book, your minimum threshold where, you know, going below that is where you're going to start running into undesirable results. So that's where you want to avoid going. So your measurable objectives is where you want the basin to be. And it has to be a quantifiable target. It's above, you want some operational flexibility in that to deal with changing conditions and droughts and other things. And it's something that as you look over your 20-year time period, we do need to have 5-year interim milestones set that are going to be tied to your actions you're going to take, where you expect the basin to be on your journey towards hitting your measurable objective. So you need to target every 5 years along that milestone. And as you do that, there may need to be adjustments to your interim milestones, either in adjusting your measurable objectives or your projects and management actions to adjust from change conditions. And again, representative monitoring sites, how do you determine whether you're in compliance with what you're wanting to do for measurable objectives and minimum threshold? Well, it's not done through modeling. Compliance is going to be set at specific representative monitoring wells that are going to be located throughout the basin. And this is, again, a technical aspect, but it's also something that we're going to be seeking input about the types of wells, whether they're adequate or not. But the monitoring is going to indicate whether the measurable objectives are being met at the point of the interim milestones that we're basing it at. So it's really the performance measure is going to be based upon empirical data coming from the representative monitoring sites. And measures can include, you know, one or more sustainability indicator, and I'll speak to that in a minute. So here's a similar slide going off where you'll have your minimum threshold and you're starting to, where that star is on the, at the 2040 site, which will be 2042 for us, is your measurable objective. This is where you want your basin to be. And you can, in the interim 20-year period, you can indicate that you might be going down into your minimum threshold. for a period of time, but you need to indicate in your interim measures, those IMs every 5 years, the pathway that you're determining to get ultimately to your measurable objective. So as we report to DWR every 5 years on those interim measures, as well as other aspects we have to do, we need to ensure that we're on that pathway towards achieving our measurable objectives. Very strong dog. So moving on, that's the big overview of what sustainable management criteria are. So again, we're gonna look to have the board workshop on SMCs on February 10th. That will then kick off a 30-day public review period. And then March 16th, we'll come back and discuss the public comments. There'll be SHAC input at that point. And hopefully we'll start getting these sustainable management criteria kind of at least drafted at that point. So before I move on to the specific methodology, I'll open up if there's any general questions on what sustainable management criteria is, measurable objectives or minimum thresholds and representative monitoring.
Any questions from board members? Hearing none, I see we have one hand up from the public. Linda, if you want to unmute Deborah Lucero and then see if there's anybody I'm missing.
Yeah, Paul, I was just wondering if when we set this criteria and we have the every 5 years as the milestone to report back to DWR, what happens in that interim period? Is it like most state law, that's the minimum for state law, but can our GSA have an annual review or set something more stringent? Or, you know, how does that work?
Yeah, that's absolutely up to how we craft the groundwater sustainability plan. We do have to report annually to DWR and monitoring results and a number of other aspects, very similar to the Butte County's groundwater status report. So there is an annual reporting. The board will be getting reports of the monitoring data. So all of that will be in the stakeholder advisory committee. So all of that's going to be public and disclosed. If we're looking even before the 5 year period, that we're really off track. That's something I would expect we would have a pretty good discussion with the stakeholder advisory committee, the board, and at any time we can go in and make adjustments to the plan if needed to make sure that we're going to stay on track to reach sustainability for the basin.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. I see no other questions from the public. Any board members follow?
Specific, and I know Joe Turner's on the line, so I'm probably not going to do justice. Somehow I was muted. So as I was going to say, I'm probably not going to do justice to the presentation that the GeoSyntech team gave to the Stakeholder Advisory Committee, but I wanted to give an overview of that criteria. And again, what was presented is only a starting point. It was just, called it a straw man. It was just something to start the conversation. Ultimately, as we look at where those minimum thresholds are set and how they're set and where we want the basin to be on measurable objectives, you know, in those representative monitoring wells and what would constitute, you know, significant, unreasonable, undesirable effects, that's all a discretionary call of the board. So all of this is up for discussion, but it's a good starting point to get the process going. So the straw man was presented to the stakeholder advisory committee. This is the list from their slide that they presented to them. There was a lot of technical materials. They were not able to get through all the sustainability indicators just because of the volume of information and the big discussion. So again, next Tuesday, there's going to be a more deep deeper dive into the details of the draft methodology for discussion. So what I'm going to focus on first is the sustainability indicator for chronic lowering of groundwater levels. And this is probably the driver for a lot of our issues in the basin, as I'll explain. So really the undesirable results statement was drafted up to indicate protection and avoiding undesirable results for the major groundwater uses and users. Shallow domestic wells are primary, as well as reduction in pumping capacity for ag, increased pumping costs, and impact to groundwater dependent ecosystems. A lot of these are going to be the drivers for sustaining the basin. So I'll get into the details of why what was presented for a minimum threshold. And again, this is where you don't want to go below or even approach, because you're going to start to result in undesirable results. So this is the floor that you want to stay away from, and you stay as far away from that as possible by your measurable objective. And I'll get into the summary of that. And then what would be defined as unreasonable when you get into that? And it kind of gets into when are you going to start getting in from a green light, yellow light, to the red light that you need to really start taking some actions. And what was proposed is some percent of the representative monitoring wells falling below the minimum thresholds for some period of time. And they threw out two consecutive years. And all of this is up for discussion and assessment. Real quickly, the representative monitoring site, the RMS, they're proposing a 3-mile radius. And what this would be is throughout the basin, the sub-basin, there would be representative monitoring sites with 3-mile radiuses across the entire sub-basin for coverage. So there would be a smattering of representative monitoring wells throughout the basin that, and in this case, how they determined the minimum threshold, they took a look at within a 3-mile radius, all the wells, the shallow domestic wells within that 3-mile radius. What they used was called box and whisker statistical approach. And if you look at, and this is within that 3-mile radius, there was 337 wells. And so just to try to determine where that minimum threshold could reasonably be set, you have, and the lines going down from the black line are wells, the different depths of wells. So some wells are deeper than others, depending upon the uses and how they were constructed. So the suggestion was if you look at the 15th percentile, that would be protective of 85% of the wells below that. And again, it doesn't mean that we're going to approach that 15th percentile level. It's a minimum threshold. The other piece is those number of wells, the 337 wells, are the entirety that are in the DWR database. There's a question whether all of those are being used, and likely there's a lot in there that are no longer in use, might have been abandoned and not. So that's also a consideration. So I'm going to, so if you take a look at your representative monitoring site location, the 3-mile round, and this is one well in the basin. This is the hydrograph of what that well had looked like. Some of it is model result and some of it's actually observed measurements. The minimum threshold in red is where that level would be set at where 15% of the wells are set. So that's the level that we don't want to approach. And as you can see, the groundwater elevation for this well has remained above that, but we do need to set the measurable objective. So setting the measurable objective, it's where do you want to set it? And those are optional lines that we'll put in. This is also going to be somewhat dependent upon each well and how variable the monitoring of the groundwater levels are within that well. Some locations are very stable, which would give you an indication about where you could reasonably set those measurable objectives. Some might have wide variation between different wet and dry cycles, which might mean you might need to be a little bit more protective. Some groundwater levels might be on a steeper decline that you might need to address and adjust. So each one of these representative monitoring sites, as we said, minimum thresholds are going to tell its own story. So as you can see, and this gets into management call on where you want to set those measurable objectives. And one is you have the trend line from the 93 to 2015 dry cycle, or you could choose the 2003 to 2015 dry cycle, or the 2010 to 15. So this is an example of where you may want to go out to the future to set those measurable objectives. As I move through, what was being suggested was setting the measurable objective at the 2015 level, so that drought, the worst drought we had, 2014-2015, would be the operational level of the basin along these lines, and it would be sufficiently above the minimum threshold. And that's where we would want to monitor to make sure that we don't go below that measurable objective. But it also, we just can't set a desire we want the basin to be without the means to get there. And that's where you need to couple your project and management actions to bring this line to level off the decline of the basin. And so that's going to be determined locally within this area about the types of uses and what types of actions could be to either increase recharge or reduce demand. So here's another example of the well, and this is modeling projections in the future that includes the Butte County 2030 general plan, Cal Water's 2050 Urban Water Management Plan, and the hydrology, the climate change projection, central tendency out to 2070. So as you can see, it looks like in the future, we'll be meeting our measurable objective. In the future, out at 2060 and beyond, there's indications that as climate change starts to kick in even stronger, we're going to start to potentially get below measurable objectives. So this is going to, as we get more analysis, drive the discussion about, okay, what will it take to move that projected line above the minimum, the measurable objective, if that is truly our intent, because we're going to need to demonstrate that we have the means to stay above that measurable objective. I should point out, and this gets back to a point earlier about every 5 years, general plans are going to change, land use decisions are going to change, there may be new data that comes out on climate change and others. So this will also be updated as to what the trend looks like, and not just where we think the basin is going to be, but as we get new data, we're going to refine on change conditions, if land use changes dramatically or other things, we will take that into account and make adjustments accordingly. So again, as I said, I think I had earlier on the groundwater sustainability plan in parentheses version one, and I did that just as to note that this plan is going to be dynamic over its lifetime as new data and circumstances change. So it is just the beginning for us to get acquainted with sustainability. So again, this is a very similar slide for the 15th percentile, which would be the minimum threshold, looking at, you know, getting into significant unreasonable would be exceeding the minimum threshold for two consecutive years and 25% of the wells in the subbasin. again, those numbers and frequencies can change. And I think as the stakeholder advisory committee will get discussions next week, looking at the basin is in its entirety and how this fits in will really guide a lot of the discussion. But again, this is just a straw man methodology. And again, another monitoring location, and this was on North Vine, as you can see, a little bit more stable conditions. And again, the same methodology based upon what I described before on the minimum threshold 15th percentile and measurable objective based upon the 2015. So that was a really brief overview of chronic lowering of groundwater levels and an approach to set sustainable management criteria. But as you see, we have reductions in storage, degradation of water quality, land subsidence, and surface water depletion. So one of the things that they allowed you to do was to use one of the indicators as proxies for the other, because some of them will drive the other indicators. For example, you know, for lowering groundwater levels, you know, is really going to drive land subsidence. If you don't have land subsidence, which we haven't had, and you're sustaining your groundwater levels, you're not going to deplete the basin to cause land subsidence. Similarly, with reduction in storage, if you're maintaining your storage levels and depending upon your basin, you can use your groundwater level indicators as your proxy for reduction in storage. So both of those are being proposed as being proxies for storage and subsidence. It doesn't mean that there'll be changes in the monitoring aspect of it. We still will be proposing monitoring for subsidence. We have some extensometers and there's other data, INSAR data and other data. There's regional approaches for subsidence monitoring that the regional agencies have conducted, so we'll continue that. Is also an indicator, and also looking at storage through groundwater pumping reports that we'll have to do annually. So one of the things with subsidence, which is interesting, is they did look at proposing a 0.2 meter reduction in, or 0.2 level of subsidence near certain infrastructure that would be affected by subsidence over time. That would be an indicator of significant and reasonable. And one of the things with subsidence, although it has a significant impact on storage in the basin because you're collapsing the clay layers or your storage capacity, really the main indicator is it going to affect infrastructure, roads, there's conveyance, there's gas lines, and other facilities that are affected by land subsidence. So really keeping a close eye on the proximity to areas that might be affected by land subsidence is key to determining whether you're having undesirable results. So depletion of interconnected surface water, I'll leave this busy slide up. This was a key facet of the act that was fairly new for water managers. It was something that I don't think anybody really disagreed with, that protecting interconnected surface water is going to be key to sustaining the basin. As you pull water out of the basin, if you do have interconnected surface water, the first thing that goes is going to be your creek or stream or river. So one of the things we want to do is to protect the natural habitat and particularly those groundwater dependent ecosystems along the corridor of interconnected surface water for groundwater uses and users. The problem we had when this went in is there wasn't a set methodology nor a monitoring program established for interconnected surface water. So the methodology being proposed is going to be largely a data gap that is going to have to be filled. It's important, I think, to lay out the methodology that will help drive the discussion on establishing a shallow monitoring network, which I believe was also identified in the basin setting report as a data gap and something that we should be looking to fill. So the methodology would be to establish a shallow monitoring network in close proximity to key streams and creeks and rivers that we want to protect, and indicating, you know, the draft was 5 feet below the base of the stream is just a starting point. A lot of that has to do with trying to be protective of groundwater dependent ecosystems. Again, this will be something that we'll have to have a lot more discussion with the Stakeholder Advisory Committee moving forward. Degradation of water quality. And this is probably one of the more unique aspects of the Act. The Groundwater Sustainability Agency, you're not responsible for managing toxins in the basin. There's a number of other agencies that are managing that, whether it's VOC plumes or nitrates or whatever. But one of the things that's important is we need to recognize what those programs are, where those contaminants are and plumes are. So one aspect is as we manage the basin and do projects, we have to make sure that we're not going to modify or exacerbate plumes that are being managed by other agencies, and to recognize where there may be insufficient water supplies if that's being thought of as a source or other thing, to recognize that. The other side is there is a control of water quality that we do need to keep an idea on, and that is as you pump the basin, you can introduce from lower portions of the basin saline intrusion from more of the brackish lower aquifers. And so that's something the county's been monitoring for over 20 years, is looking at water quality, look at temperature, electroconductivity, and pH. So one of the thoughts was, as we take a look at water quality, is to set those minimum thresholds and measurable objectives based upon secondary water quality standards for salinity. And it's really keeping an eye to make sure that we're not over-exercising the basin and introducing saline into the basin that would make what we have right now a pretty high quality groundwater basin into something that would be contaminated from saline. So again, that is a brief overview of the sustainable management criteria methodology. As I said, the Stakeholder Advisory Committee is going to discuss this in greater detail next Tuesday. The GeoSyntec team is pulling together, based upon their last results, more detailed representation of what this would mean for the basin. We're going to present this back to the board for the board workshop in February. I think I had those dates swapped. So I think the board meeting is on the 19th, if I'm correct, in public comment period. So with that, I'll open up this point for questions on sustainable management criteria and methodology.
Are there any questions from board members? I have some, but I'm waiting for my peers if they have any. Hearing none, I'll start. I had sent an email to Paul and he covered a few of them, which I definitely appreciated. I tried to send my questions in advance to be proactive. There are a couple that I still have. One of them is, I think you addressed that the straw man means that a few of these numbers that we see about specific things are hypothetical at this stage, and that at next week's meeting and in the public process, we'll narrow them down a little more. So in other words, those specific groundwater levels, the subsidence level that was very specific in the presentation, and the sorry, the stream level, those types of numbers were just kind of thrown out as examples. So we shouldn't hang our hat too much on them when we see them in the report at this stage. Is that correct?
Exactly right. Those are starting points for discussion. And ultimately, as we get input from the Stakeholder Advisory Committee and the public, ultimately, the board's going to make the decisions as to where to set those in the plan. But you're going to be afforded, you know, the input and discussion and the alternatives that are going to be put forward from the Stakeholder Advisory Committee and the public. So it's our hope you'll have a full suite of the options and decisions that you can will make to include in the plan.
In the terminology of stream, does that mean specifically what I would think of if I look up in the dictionary, or does stream mean any kind of flow? So Feather River, Sacramento River, and any stream and creek?
Yes, it would be any basic surface water that's running, creek, stream, river, that's connected to groundwater.
So when we say that we have a data gap, is it because we don't have specific data for all of our types of flowing surface water specific to our area? Or is it because this is a relatively new area of study and there aren't models or other things that we could use even as a straw man kind of basis?
Yeah, this is relatively new area, and I think part of the data gap is not having the right type of monitoring infrastructure along creeks and streams to be able to characterize your compliance with your measurable objectives and minimum thresholds. And if Joe's on, you can raise his hand if he wants to clarify anything.
Not hearing any volunteering, so that's fine, great. And then my last question is actually something I didn't send you, it arose during the presentation. A meeting or two ago, we had a discussion about comparing different climate change model assumptions. You know, City of Chico has its cap, Butte County has its cap. They didn't use exactly the same methodology. How far along we are in that process, and if it's something we're gonna be able to bring to bear next week, or if that's something we're going to have to take into account later in our process? We do have a clock that's ticking, and I just want to know where we are.
Yeah. We started to take a look at, you know, Chico's Climate Action Plan, the Butte County Action Plan. So we're starting to pull that together. So it won't be ready for next week, but we're working on it.
Great. Perfect. Thank you. So
and
those were
my... Go ahead, his hand up.
Oh, wait, he did. Okay, wonderful. I'm sorry. I didn't see him on my screen. Linda, can you activate him?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
I'm sorry. Yes. I was trying to raise my hand, but I couldn't find it quick enough while you guys were talking. So anyway, now it's been everything. So the question and what Paul was saying about the stream channels and everything. So first point is it's natural stream channels. We're not talking about any ditches or anything like that. That's the terminology we're using. So that's natural stream channels. And then what the data gap is we have real good stream hydrology data, but we have poor geologic data for the shallowest aquifer. That's what we don't have. So we really don't know how the groundwater reacts to the surface. And that's the part we really don't have. We already have the model, and that's in the plan, we're using the model to make the approach made with saying we don't have the data, but the model is what we will use to show what this is what we think's going on. So we do have a model. It does show things, but there's just no data to support it. And so it's to show the approach. And the other thing just say is DWRs recognize this, and they're really not going to make any comments other than the approach till 2025, because they've realized nobody has this data. So they already know that real numbers aren't really going to come until 2025.
Great, thank you. That was my understanding. I appreciate it.
Chair Tuschinski, this is Valerie Kincaid. I just wanted to add one thing on that sustainable management criteria piece, is that it's by far not only the least data, but the most intricate. And by that, I mean its beneficial uses of interconnected surface water. So you're not only looking at how surface water connects or does not connect with groundwater, but you're also looking at where that interconnection affects beneficial uses. So there's, it's kind of like a, compared to the other sustainability indicators, it's a little bit of a 10-piece step process. It's definitely the most complicated and probably the newest. So it's a tough one.
So I get a feeling then that when we see it, it won't be quite as quite as singular as it was presented in the presentation, which is part of the reason I asked the question, is when I saw that it said five feet from the surface. And I was thinking, well, that seems rather uniform of a measure when, if we're talking about potentially different types of bodies of water, for a layman's way of expressing it. That's why I now have a better understanding that we may be, because it was such a straw man thing and we are dealing with something that's varying. I now have a better understanding that we're gonna be much more specific, I think, in our approach to it. So I think I understand that better. If assuming I've explained that correctly, Paul.
Yes, yep.
Great. Were there any comments or questions from the public? Now that I've occupied so much time. Great, Deborah Lucero and Jim Brobeck have their hands up, Linda, so I'll let you unmute them in whichever order you choose. And anyone else you may see that's on off my screen.
Thank you. I was just wondering, I wanted to be clear on this, and it's a clarifying question. Do these studies take into consideration current agricultural use or only urban uses as per the general plan?
It was based on the entire basin setting, which includes all uses, ag and ground and urban.
Okay. And then I just wondered, you mentioned 3-mile radius areas as the calculated areas. And then you mentioned the 337 wells. Was that just specific to that 3-mile area, or that's not for the entire VINA GSA, correct?
Correct. So that was the 3-mile area around that one representative monitoring well. Those were the number of wells that was in DWR's database that were permitted in that area. So as we go and start doing those circles around representing monitoring wells throughout the entire sub-basin, there'll be different numbers of domestic wells, if that's gonna be the driver on this, in each one around those, each one of those representative monitoring wells.
And then you had mentioned that some of those wells may be dry, some of them, you know, you're not really sure. Is that data going to be cleaned up so that it doesn't, you know, make this other data maybe skewed somewhat?
Yeah, and that was a big discussion at the Stakeholder Advisory Committee. It's something, and again, the minimum threshold down at that level is a point we don't want to get near. Not only that we don't want to go past it, but we want to stay sufficiently above it at the measurable objective. So we're hoping, whether those wells are in operation or not, that as we set the measurable objective, we will be protective enough. But that was also another aspect we were thinking is, as if this methodology goes forward, something we would take a look at, to look at what wells are actually in operation, which ones may have been abandoned or not in use, and so that could also be an ongoing project to flesh out. Because obviously, if it turns out this methodology looks good, and we think that okay, maybe out of that 15%, there might be 5% that are there, and as long as we don't get to the minimum threshold, we'll be fine. But then, if we start seeing that as we go forward, that no, it's actually maybe more, and there might be impacts. That's where, again, I think your first point, cause immediate action to make some adjustments to this.
Thank you.
Yeah, this is Jim. I have a question for Valerie. You talked about the complexity of beneficial uses of surface water. I remember reading a study a few years ago about how much water, surface water, is leaking into groundwater from groundwater use, and how it's impacting water rights for people with surface water rights downstream from the leakage. Is this one of the considerations that we need to take into account?
Well, that's a good a good question. It's probably not something that is required by SGMA, but it is, as stream users, you are a beneficial user. So if you put together a plan that had what was either a neutral or a gaining river, and that plan allowed it to be a losing river. And for those who don't know, a gaining river is a river that is supported, or the stream flow is increased by groundwater, kind of a shallow groundwater supply. And a losing river is obviously where the surface water supplies the groundwater. And so if you had a situation, or if you allowed a plan and sustainability to cause a big shift like that, then that would be a beneficial use of water that you should consider. A lot of folks are not drilling down into those issues because they are frankly more focused on establishing which reaches have interconnection and whether those reaches affect the beneficial uses of the ground of the interconnection. So GDEs, and usually those GDEs are kind of, you know, rooted shallow trees that are impacted by that fluctuation of when groundwater and surface water interact. But you are correct. If you had a plan that was so extreme and it allowed a gaining river to become a losing river, you would need to think of a beneficial use of stream flow and how those surface water diverters are affected. I don't know if that answers your question, Jim, but those are my thoughts kind of on it.
Well, he muted himself and put his hand down, so I think you did well. So thank you so much.
Sure.
Linda, I don't see any other hands up. If you don't, then I will close the public comment. I'll go back. If there are any board members that have any... Oh, I'm sorry. Did you have more? I'm sorry. Forgive me.
Yeah, I have two other pieces of the GSP status to go through real briefly. Okay, that was the bulk, but I'll finish up.
Great. Thank you so much. Forgive me.
So again, spoke a little bit about project and management actions, and these are the means to get to where we want the measurable objectives to be. So we've had a lot of discussion with the SHAC about, you know, what would this constitute in the plan. It has to be part of the plan, and it's going to comprise the efforts that will achieve the measurable objectives for each of the indicators. The SHAC, we spent a lot of time talking about types of projects and management actions, created a glossary to discuss it, but that discussion kind of started a little early before we started talking about sustainable management criteria. So it was hard to really get your head around about project and management actions without really knowing where are we going and how far do we need to get to. But it was a really good discussion about the types of projects and actions, whether demand reduction or increased recharge that would be part of the plan. So we're going to continue the discussion on potential project and management actions. There was discussions of legal implications of artificial recharge. There's you know, potential with concerns on the hypothetical about different projects, depending upon how they go forward, that could lead, identify, and we've identified some of these potential management actions by the VINA board to be put up guardrails, if you will, to ensure that some of those extreme things that would be deleterious to the basin and in conflict with the plan are not allowed to go forward. So we'll continue those discussions with the SHAC and get recommendations, But really the next step, we're going to start soliciting potential specific potential projects and management actions through a fillable form online. This has been done in other sub-basins. So we can start really evaluating and have the SHAC weigh in on some of these specific actions and stop thinking about some of those considerations they had talked about into the practical terms. So again, we're hoping that the range of the types of project and management actions are going to include a large suite of them that'll include demand reduction through conservation and other aspects, as well as potential recharge. Those might be into consideration. Some may be planned. They may be planned projects that we can incorporate, and they'll have, you know, good timing and pretty well dialed in. There might be potential ones that might need a few things, such as a funding source or additional analysis. And then there might be some good, just good concepts out there that we may not want to lose sight of, because in time, add more actions in to meet our measurable objectives. So we do want a pretty good repository of the type of projects that we would find acceptable and supportive of the plan. So this was an example type of matrix that would come up on the different types of projects that would happen. I will point out, you know, we'll probably get projects related to conservation, both urban and ag. We've been working with Farm Bureau and ag users and UC Davis researchers to identify what practices are going on in the basin for irrigation and try to identify the opportunities to improve ag irrigation efficiency to hopefully reduce the demand on basin and still maintain good agricultural production. So hope to have more to report on that at the next meeting. So with that, I'll move into interbasin coordination. And again, why are we dealing with interbasin coordination? In the Act, it states that one agency's plan cannot impede the achievement of their sustainability goal of an adjoining subbasin. And really what it means is these plans need to be coordinated. They need to ensure that there's good communication and that one plan isn't going to adversely impact an adjoining sub-basin. That's all good. I think most plans that got submitted had not really taken this on very well. There was a lot of reports that some of the 2020 plans actually are setting themselves up to do that without any real dialogue. So in the Sac Valley, we recognize that these basins are really interconnected, and we do need to ensure that our plan isn't going to impact an adjoining sub-basin, nor is the adjoining sub-basin going to impede our goal. And if you look at where we are in the Vina sub-basin, to the north, we have Los Molinos, to the west, Corning, and to the south, Butte sub-basin. So that's Butte sub-basin in our own backyard. Bring this home to us as we develop as staff working in both sub-basins, how we reconcile and make sure that those plans don't trip over each other. So we in the region were benefited by DWR funding the Consensus Building Institute to facilitate discussions among groundwater sustainability agencies on interbasin coordination. They're leading this effort, and it's probably the most robust interbasin coordination effort that has occurred in SGMA. And they've started their process, I think rightfully so, trying to work with the managers and consultants to compile all the technical information about the starting point, about what models are being used, different technical aspects on the views of where interbasin flows go and all that. And it got to be quite the extensive process. It also became a lot slower than I think the schedule planned for. And it turned out that different sub-basins are at different points in their development of their plan, and some haven't completed their basin setting work. So it's kind of also delayed sort of getting a good compilation of where we're at for some of the technical aspects. And really what we wanted to get down to at the end was having the dialogue and coordination to ensure that we're not going to impact each other as we get down the line. So this has gone somewhat slower. There's been a lot of concern. We've heard the concerns from the public about wanting more public meetings and having the discussions among the agencies more open. CBI has been reporting out to the various boards and advisory committees on the status of the effort, but still there's interest in wanting to open this up. And I think the CBI schedule had indicated we have all this information compiled and then start having a lot of good public dialogue on that, but it's been slowed. We brought this issue to their attention. We do think it is going to be good in the public interest to start having more public dialogue. I don't think it serves us all to just sit and compile as much as we need to a lot of technical information given the nature of this topic. So we're brought to that their attention. They're retooling kind of where we're at, and hopefully and shortly we'll come out with they'll come out with sort of a updated plan on where to go from here. In the meantime, knowing that there was an interest as to the discussions and the technical information that was being compiled, we offered to host on our webpage, on our Sigma page, the interbasin coordination. So you can see meeting summaries that were held and the information in the matrices that were compiled. So anyways, there's a lot more work to be done on that. And we should hopefully hear from CBI on sort of the next steps on how they're going to proceed forward on this. So with that, I'll open it up for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Any questions from members of the board? Any questions from members of the public? I see Jim Brobeck's hand is up. And if you want to unmute him, unless I have that power. Maybe I have the power. Nope, I don't have that power.
Mr. Chair, you don't have the power?
No, maybe next meeting.
There we go. Thanks, Evan. Thanks, Paul. As Paul mentioned, the Northern Sacramento Valley Interbasin Coordination Group was formed to assure that management in one basin does not prevent nearby basins from achieving sustainability goals. I have been tracking the summaries, and I want to thank Mariana for posting the December Interbasin Coordination meeting notes. I studied them today. Thanks, Mariana. I noticed that the December Interbasin Coordination meeting notes explain the preliminary data for Butte, Colusa, Corning, Vina, and Wyandotte Creek for cross-boundary flows were ready, and preliminary estimates show that there are some differences in cross-boundary flow results. So I hope to have a summary of the cross-boundary flow differences at the upcoming SHAC meetings. According to the meeting summary, participants agreed to continually communicate questions and concerns expressed during their respective meetings so that the group can address issues as they emerge. And I am very, very interested in that. I've studied some of the results from a 2007 Glen Clusa irrigation test well, and they did an isotope study that pretty clearly showed that the recharge for the lowest portion of the aquifer that they're tapping over there on the other side of the river comes from the east and from the north, from the foothills and the mountains. So that really indicates an interbasin flow at the deepest levels and what I think of as the foundation, the footing for our aquifer system. So it's really important that we keep up to speed and up to date on both the science and the model runs on this. I think this might be a good time to, this might come up in the shack, but I may as well bring it up now because it's part of the PMA discussion. Valerie Kincaid, our legal counsel, created a document that describes the legal implications of recharge projects. Paul, you mentioned that. And she did explain in the document that the project proponent for a recharge project would gain water rights over recharged groundwater. And that if surface water is diverted to recharge an aquifer, the recharged water that was used remains the possession of the diverter, the recharger, and the diverter or recharger may exercise full control over that water. So that really jumped out at me on the legal analysis. And I don't know if this document has been shared with the board, but if not, I hope it will be. And I hope the board takes some time to review it, to understand some of the concerns we have about artificial recharge projects and how it may affect overlying landowner rights to groundwater. And Paul, thanks for getting that legal analysis of the consequences of recharge projects out there for us to review. Appreciate it. Thanks, Evan.
Thank you, Jim. Appreciate that. I don't see any other comments. So, with that, I just want to ask if there are any board members that have any direction. This is just an informational item, but we can give direction to staff. So if there's any, seeing no direction for the management team on this, we will move on to item 6.2, which is consideration of the 2021 VINA GSA board regular meeting calendar. Linda Herman.
Yes, thank you, Chair Jasinski. So the previous board had set the regular meetings for the board meetings at 5:30 p.m. on the second Wednesday of the month. I just want to end every year. We have been bringing a calendar for the whole year. Because we have two new board members, I wanted to make sure and see if that meeting date works for those two new board members, or if there are some conflicts from either board member that we would want to choose an alternative date and time. So that's my first question, is if that is the correct, still an okay date and time that we would continue. And then there's a calendar attached that we would have you approve for the full year. But mainly just wanted to ask the question if that's a problem from some new board members.
Great.
Yeah, this is Cammie Denley. It looks good to me. I see the calendar, and that doesn't interfere with any of, you know, the council obligations. So it looks good to me.
Thank you.
Yeah, and this is Todd Kimmelshue, and I have no problem with that calendar. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I would only ask Linda, if we do get to go back to in-person sometime during the year, is that fine with the Chico City Council Chambers schedule? We had set that, you know, we've kind of been working on that schedule in part because that was when Chico City Council Chambers were available. Is that likely still to be the same?
Yeah, so we'll firm that up. I was going to do that after this meeting, but we chose that particular date also because it was one of the dates that seems to be free in our council chambers, correct?
Wonderful, great.
And then just to let you know, we are moving to the Zoom platform for the city council, so we might be able to continue with the Zoom meetings if we have to in the interim and not have to use the WebEx that we had used in the past, so we'll have some better capabilities there, so.
I don't know if we need a motion on this. It sounds like we have unanimous on this. Do you need a motion on this, Linda, or just?
No, I think we could say this consensus, unless you want to open it up to public comment in case there's any public comment, just in case.
Okay, thank you. I'll open up to public comment. Any? Hearing none, we'll consider the matter settled and move on to 7, communications and reports. 7.1, VINA GSA Management Committee updates. 7.1.1, VINA Stakeholder Advisory Committee update. Kelly Peterson had done a written report. I don't know if she has anything that she wants to add. I know she has one line that's here. I don't know if that's her speaking line.
Sorry about that. thank you, Chair. This is Kelly Peterson with Butte County, and Yeah, I just wanted to read a couple of quick bullet points on the SHAC. As we talked a lot about today, they did meet back in December with the new domestic well user representative that was appointed by this board at the last meeting. And so that member, that 10-member committee is now full and functioning well. The draft meeting notes are part of the packet, and also Paul did a really good thorough overview of a lot of the content that was discussed at that meeting. The recordings are also posted online within 2 to 3 days after the meeting. So if anyone's ever interested, there's video and audio of those particular discussions. So that's available. And like Paul said, at their next meeting on January 19th, next Tuesday, we'll be taking a deeper dive on SMCs and continuing those discussions with a new member representing Cal Water, which will be David Kent. So with that, I'll turn it over to the next item or for any questions.
Great. Maybe we'll just handle any questions at the end, if that's okay. It seems like we've got some quick reports here. 7.1.2, DWR Technical Support Facilitation Services Facilitation Services Update. Well, that's a mouthful. Paul Gosselin.
Yeah, I'm pleased to announce Department of Water Resources did approve technical support services for facilitation through CBI. So all that work that Tanya and Mariana are doing with the SHAC is going to continue. So we're very grateful for that. You did a great job facilitating all that. Again, they're also tasked with doing the interbasin coordination work also. So that's real key and a real really benefit that they're carrying that out. So we're very happy with that. Moving to Rock Creek Reclamation District, we do have the executed agreement with them to work cooperatively on a single plan. We've invited them in with the management committee on planning on GSPs for closer coordination. And they're also participating as an agency rep on the stakeholder advisory committee to be real familiar as the discussion presentations, because that's been the focal point of presentations from staff and technical team on GSP development. So all that, we have it synced up, and hopefully we're gonna stay on track to continue to do a single plan between the two GSAs and the Vine subbase. And lastly, Tuscan Water District, we have not received anything from LAFCO about an application, but if and when we do, we'll notify the board. And what LAFCO has done is they notify agency when there's an agency formation and ask for comments, and they'll usually list out some key comments. So that's it for the report.
Great. Thank you, Paul. Any questions from board members? Any questions from members of the public? Anything, Linda? Okay, then. Oh, I'm sorry, Linda, did you? Okay, I saw her leave.
Say no, I have not received CM.
Okay, I got the head fake. Then we'll move to item 8, adjournment. We will adjourn to the next regular VINA GSA board meeting on February 10th, and that will be the workshop. So look forward to seeing everybody in workshop mode. Thank you all.
Thank you, have a good evening.
Thanks, bye everybody.
Thank you, everybody.